You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things.
It's go time, baby.
Go. Good. All right. Hello and welcome to Curiosity Invited. And my name is David Bryan. And today I have the pleasure of speaking to somebody I've just met for the first time. His name is Stephen Griffin. And I think he's a very interesting fellow from all the stuff I have bumped into. And there's plenty of it. He is not necessarily in this order. He is an author, a speaker, a teacher, an entrepreneur, an innovator, and at the core, he is a coach, and I think a coach in all sorts of ways. And hopefully, we'll talk about that. And so, Stephen, thank you. Thanks for being on Curiosity Invited, and ready to dig in.
David, it's my pleasure. I'm ready to go with you.
Good, good. Spoken like a true coach. How'd you get to this? I mean, I see a sign. Move your head a little bit, and we'll see that sign fully. It says A Game Coaching, and that's the name of your company, yeah?
Yes, yeah. So, the 2-minute commercial. Born and raised in Chicago. Played football, and was an amateur boxer. And you know, that was my passion, to be a professional athlete. And over the years, some injuries in football, some injuries in boxing, ended up that wasn't going to happen. So came out to Los Angeles. My undergrad and graduate work was in exercise science. I opened up a training facility for athletes in the early 90s. And it was one of the first like private facilities for professional athletes, amateur athletes, also, you know, executives. And it was there where...
This was in Los Angeles?
Yes, Hermosa Beach, actually, called The Yard. It's still there. And in that journey is where I found myself to be a coach. And in that process, I also found that on the outside, it looked great, David. But me and the inside, I was a mess.
Oh, wow.
And what I realized was, you know, I was never really over not becoming a professional athlete. And I was struggling. So I hired a coach. Now, this is in the 90s, you know, the internet, you know, you could. So I found a coach, and the coach was in the field of what we call neuro-linguistic programming. It was just one area of psychology.
Yeah.
And I realized that a lot of my beliefs that I had about myself weren't true. And I didn't really have the skills to mentally and emotionally regulate myself. And so I started doing some coaching with this gentleman. And then I was really intrigued about this area of psychology. So I started training in that and started using those tools as I shifted and changed my life, started using it with my athletes and executives. And then in 1999, I was really called at a deeper level to take this knowledge out into the world. So that's when I started was high performance coaching, now A-Game Coaching, and started working with executives, entrepreneurs, business owners, as well as athletes at all ages. Started writing some books. And then, you know, recently in the last couple of years, my focus has now been very directed to student athletes, high school and college, as well as the parents and coaches. And I work with a significant amount of NFL players. I have 40 NFL players that have coached that are in the league right now.
Wow.
And so I've been doing pre-combine mental work for the last 3 years in that area. So that kind of brings me up to today.
And well, now my head's going in two directions, but let me just take this one. So what you say, you're working with NFL players. Does that interfere with, do they get pushback about having another coach?
Like, well, that's a great question. So, for 3 years in a row, I've been hired from different athletic organizations or agents, right? So what I do is I have a game mindset program for their athletes. So what I do is I help them tools to regulate their mind and their emotions, right? Mm-hmm. And I spend a lot of time preparing them for the interviews with the coaches. So when you go to the combine as an athlete, you are going to get interviewed by every team, either the owner or the head coach. And this is where a big part of my work is helping, you know, young men and women really being able to articulate their purpose, their why, mm-hmm. and be able to articulate who they are. Because at the end of the day, as you know, you can have two or three or four athletes all at the same level, but it's how you connect in relationship that's going to make the difference. So back to your original question, yes, there is some pushback. And I'm well versed at that pushback. And here's the pushback. So I show up in the room, you know, on their syllabus, it says psych. That's all it says. Then they say to me, right? You know, I'm still a big guy. I'm about 6'4", 6'5", 240. A lot of the guys, you know, when they see me, they're like, hey, you look like you could still play. That's a compliment. Couldn't do that. But really my approach is, you know, all I'm here to do is what I call close a performance gap. You're here and you want to get here. And we all have performance gaps when we want to get to the next level. And so what I share with them is these tools are going to help close that performance gap. And I start every training with this statement: what got you here won't take you there. Mm. We've got to up level. And so how I get the buy-in is very interactive tools that work.
So your focus as a coach, at least with you know, players playing at that level, with athletes playing at those levels, is primarily on their approach, their mindset. You're not trying to teach them physical skills.
No, I retired in 1990. Yeah, I still have those tools, right? Yeah. Occasionally I'll take an athlete, teach them some boxing tools, but it's all mindset.
Yeah.
And what we do early on, especially with the high school, the college, and the pros, is I do an exercise called analyzing your A game. Most athletes have never looked at what does it take mentally to be at my best. So I have them look at a low performance and we go through what were their thoughts, their emotions, their body language, their energy. And then we look at their A game and the same thing. And that's where the first aha shows up. Oh, My thoughts are different. My emotions are different. And that becomes the template for me to coach them how to get in their A game. And here's just as important, David, if they're out of their A game, because they know these different categories, what to do about it.
Mm. So, I mean, this we can put this on the cutting room floor, but this is really just for me. You know, I have often thought, like when you watch players at this exceedingly high levels, right, that, well, you know, this person's got a great jump shot and this person shoots from the outside, or this person's faster than that person. But we're talking about, in most cases, degrees of difference that are so minimal. And yet there are some people who, you know, I mean, they're just, their mental focus, it almost seems like the will to win and the will to achieve is unshakable. And is that at that level, is that really what separates those real? I mean, you know, obviously there's some people who are just amazing, but.
100%. So when we look at the growth mindset, understanding that we have the ability through neuroplasticity and training to actually improve, that our mind is not fixed. When I work with the NFL players, and I know we're talking about them, but this goes all the way back to juniors, is they, for the most part of their career, have been able to out-physical their problem.
Right. Right.
Now they're going into a pool of sharks.
Yeah.
This is business, right?
All really good, all really fast, all really adept.
And what I tell all my athletes, the further you go into your career, the less the physical is important. And here's what I mean by that. Of course, you have to work your craft now it's the mindset. And by the way, it's the least trained and the most important when you start with high school and college and to the pros. I have a professional football player. His name's Kaimi Fairbairn. He's the kicker for the Houston Texans. I've been working with him for 3 years. already an exceptional kicker. And they brought me in. He was coming off an injury a couple of years ago, was not quite in the mindset. And then we got him very focused on his A-game approach. And one of the biggest things was doing that analysis, but being in the moment. And my quote on this is, the more present you are, the higher you perform. And so it's the ability to get rid of the distractions, to be in the moment. And when we're in the moment, we have the ability to step into that flow state. And so a lot of the work that I'm doing with young people and professionals is training them to be in the moment. They get distracted, to come back, and just tools to regulate, you know, the negative emotions and cultivate positive emotions at will. Mm-hmm. At will.
Mm-hmm. And that's your focus with, at least with most of your coaching with young people, with whomever, is that. And so how do you do that? You don't need to do a workshop right here, but
right. Now, this is that? I get, listen, yeah. David, I'll talk all day on this, but really ultimately, and I'll take a young athlete, for example, because it's the same. And so when I start with them, we do an analysis, but really here are the categories of that I'm working with. And so number one, mindfulness, teaching them to be present in the moment, not to judge things, but to be present and evaluate what's going on. Also be able to come back from distractions. Number two, and I'll talk more deeply about this, is how to be self-compassionate to yourself.
Yeah, that came up out in your stuff and is like, so what's that about? And why is that? Why is that part of an athlete's success?
Right. I'm going to tell you that one moment. I'm going to give the other two categories and I'll come back. So we have that. Then we have the sports psychology perspective, tools to cultivate the right mindset. So a mindset means this: how you process and organize information. That's what a mindset means. People say mindset. Well, what is that? How you process and organize information. And the last tool that I coach is communication, how to communicate with your teammates, your parents, your coaches. Mm-hmm. But let's go back to self-compassion. So I've always been about 10 years ahead. So when I started really digging into mindfulness, you would go into the bookstore and there'd be 3 books on mindfulness. You go into the bookstore, 15 years later, there's 500.
Oh my God. It's like, you can't get away from it.
Right. And so kind of the same thing with self-compassion. So I was introduced to self-compassion, the two top researchers in the world, Christine Neff and Chris Germer. And I was in a seminar several years ago and they said something. They said, oh, by the way, self-compassion improves performance. And I don't think anyone in the whole room, 500 people, heard it, mostly therapists. And I was like, so then there was a private lunch I had with them and I started really looking at the research. So I went through their teacher's training. I've been researching this for several years, but here's what self-compassion is from a perspective of performance. It's what I call your positive inner coach. Being there for yourself in the face of adversity, upset, suffering, or when things don't go your way. Most people in a perceived failure beat themselves up. They're in the critical mind.
Sure.
The critical mind activates the sympathetic nervous system. Self-compassion activates the parasympathetic, the rest and recovery. So teaching young people at the simplest form, when there is a challenge, how to be in your corner for yourself, how to create the right self-dialogue. And in that process, we know from research, increased resilience, increased grit, better recovery from failure. And here's most important, we will go for it in a bigger way. We will go for it in a bigger way because we know if we fail or we don't get what we want, we're not going to beat ourselves up. And see, that's the thing that starts happening. If we know over time, if we screw this up, we're going to beat ourselves up, we start to not go for it as much. In this process, is a big part of the training is, you know, how are you there for yourself? And I do an exercise that illuminates all this. I say, hey, think about a friend that has a problem. And so I said, well, how do you talk to them? What's your voice tone? What's your, like, how are you with them? So, you know, soft voice tone, kind. And now I say, okay, take a breath. Now think about when you have that problem. And then you see all the eyes in the room go, how do you talk to yourself? And about 90% of the time, the self-talk to self is hypercritical. It's very different. And I always ask my athletes, so why is that? Why do you talk to your friends, loved ones in a way, and you talk to yourself differently? It's just how we've been trained. And a lot of people resist it, not so much the way I teach it, because they feel like, oh, it's going to make me soft.
Right.
It's going to take my edge off.
Right.
The way I teach it, it's just basically saying, hey, secure your mental and emotional position first. There's three steps to self-compassion. Number one is mindfulness, being present that you're actually in a challenge. Number two, common humanity. This is a big one, is that what I'm going through, other people are going through. It's a human experience. A lot of times when an athlete or an executive are beating themselves up, they start to move themselves mentally away from the tribe, and they identify that something defective is with them. And this is where a lot of shame can come up. Mm-hmm. So by bringing the mindset back into, hey, you know, I'm struggling right now, and this is normal. Step three is this actual self-kindness, the language you're using to self, how you're talking to yourself, and the actions. And then I've added a step four in the literature, and what I call the performance step. And it's after you go through those first three steps, David, now you're emotionally stable. You're in a good place. Now evaluate what you need to learn, the teachings and understandings, and get back out there and kick some butt. Mm. So it's a whole process of just being there for yourself. And the last training I did for high school and college athletes, men and women, different ages, different sports, the number one takeaway they told me was this: I had no idea what I was going through, everyone else is going through. Mm.
So can I ask a question? How do folks get to you? Like, so, and how long, so you got a bunch of athletes, how long do you work with them?
Great question. So, I have an online program. So very simple 3-hour online program. So that's an access to anyone. Also on my online program at agamecoach.com is, a phrase, and the phrase is this: if economics are a problem, the training is free. And wow, Here's why. My mom raised me in Chicago, me and my brother. My mom would have never been able to afford me as an athlete. And I want to make sure, same thing on my Instagram, all this stuff is free. So that's the first level. Yeah. And then, you know, I have a select amount of time for one-on-one clients. And when I work out one-on-one, it's very, very focused. I do a 4-hour session of alignment, and then we do sessions after that. And that's usually for 3 to 4 months. And then the people that want to continue, we just get on a monthly program. But my goal, my passion for this is everyone has this access. Because growing up, one of the biggest passions for me, I didn't have a father in the picture, and no one ever told me how to regulate myself. And it was really tough. And I remember when I started boxing when I was 18, my mom said, hey, you can play football, but boxing, you're not doing it. So when I turned 18,
people are punching you.
Yeah. So when I turned 18, I went down to the gym, and I met a guy who became my mentor. His name was Tom Delaney. And this is the power of one person in someone's life. You know, this as an educator and the thousands of people that you've influenced, it only takes one person to really see who you are,
right,
and know your potential. Because I had a chip on my shoulder. So Tom Delaney really knew how to connect with me. He really knew. He could see that I had confidence, but he could also see there was places where I doubted. So he took me under his wing, did very well, got into the finals of the Golden Gloves the first year, took second. The next year, I won the state Illinois boxing championship. And
at heavyweight.
And you know, the thing is this: that whole time, no one told me how to regulate. I mean, Tom was awesome as a human being, but he didn't have the skills. But
sure,
you know, I remember in the finals of the Golden Gloves in Chicago, UIC Pavilion, in front of about 10,000 people, and I was scared to death. And I remember like waiting for my bout, and I was like, what's wrong with me? Mm. And you know, Mike Tyson, you know, years later, one of his quotes is like, or his comments was, he was like, I was scared to death every time I walked into the ring. And so for me, you know, when you look at young people today, David, you know, the stats, I've got them written down here. 33% of high school and college kids feel overwhelmed. 70% have some kind of anxiety and stress, and 37% of them, have some depressive qualities.
Well, you know, I was going to ask you about, so, you know, it's hard to see ourselves back then, right? You know, we can remember, but you've been doing what you're doing, or versions of what you're doing, for what, 20 years, maybe more?
Closer to 30 now.
Closer to 30 years.
I calculated 25,000 hours of coaching so far.
There you go. So, are the demands, are kids in the same spot with those things? Or are there needs now that didn't exist then? Like, you know, do the kids today have different sorts of needs than the kids back then? Or you know, the technology, the understandings are different now and deeper, and clearly people understand the role of mind, or at least the importance of mind. They may not understand the role of it now and how it can help, but is the different technology addressing different problems, or is it the same stuff that athletes have been going through forever?
Yes, same stuff. Different environment. So at the core, we're the same. We, you know, our brain has not changed. Yeah. There is more access. The biggest challenge today for young people, and I'll add, you know, older folks as well, is now we're in a constant 24/7 self-comparison to other people. Yeah. And this is why the self-compassion part is so important. You turn on Instagram, any of the other platforms, you're just seeing the best of the best of the best. You're not seeing the challenging side of people, right? So that is the biggest difference. And then and the secondary part of that is time. And so we're in an environment where our focus is being on, say, we'll just say on our phones or on Instagram. So that's time away from actually working on our craft and potentially putting us in a negative mindset about self-comparison.
Right. That self-comparison piece is really, you know, and especially for young people, but for almost everybody, right? I mean, especially when they're young, though, is, you know, everything they do is either a feather in their cap or a kick in the teeth, right? I mean, it's like, am I as good as, am I better than, this person's better at this. And it's like, it's constant, right? It's constant.
Yeah, 100%. And this is where, you know, I move kids, you know, there was a whole movement, you probably experienced this, where, you know, self-esteem was a big deal. We got to work on self-esteem.
Right.
You know, a big part of self-esteem is that you're judging yourself against another person.
Right.
How am I? So I don't like the word. Yeah. I work on self-alignment, self-confidence, mm-hmm. and what I call working from the inside out, getting yourself aligned. What is your motivation? What are your values? And in that way, the more aligned an individual is, the more they're self-referencing their happiness, their success, versus letting the outside world dictate how they think and feel on a daily basis. And that's a big thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting thing to be able to address that. Do you ever work with athletes, young people who, you know, they're not that good. They don't have any dreams about going off. They don't have any dreams about being a professional athlete or anything.
All the time.
They just want to get better. they just want to feel good about themselves.
Right. So when we look at sports, right? So even if you are the elite, okay, and you are at the top of the top, you will have more life left after sports.
Totally.
And your life in sports. So when I work with young people, David, this is about life skills. If I get a parent that says, hey, I'm hiring you for one thing, I want my kid to be an Olympian, an NBA player, and you know, I'll just say, hey, listen, here's how I work. I'm going to develop a young woman or a young man into the best human being they can be.
Right.
And so the skills I'm teaching are for academics, life, and sports. And, you know, I will say most parents get that. Every once in a while, you know, but at the end of the day, I'm interested in developing, you know, high functioning, happy, self-aligned young people.
Yeah.
That's my goal.
It's funny. It took me back there. It just flashed on a memory. So one of the things I did in my past, I have a master's in kinesiology from UCLA, actually.
Okay.
And we would periodically, you know, it was UCLA and it was kinesiology and, you know, some researchers. And so we would get some top athletes coming in to get, you know, am I throwing the discus right? Whatever.
Right.
And every once in a while we would get a parent coming in who, you know, I want you to do a muscle biopsy on my 12-year-old son, right, daughter, because I want to know what sport to push him in the direction to make sure that he achieves. And it's like, oh my God, that poor child.
David, you know the Russians have been doing that since the 60s. So
I know. It was insane. As far as I was concerned, it's like that parent needed to, like, wow, are you sure? Are you sure you want to be doing this to your child? Why don't you ask him what he likes?
Yeah. And that brings up a good point, because, you know, when I tell parents, you know, I think the role as a parent is really simple, and you know, also I do work with young men and women in the arts. So it's not just sports. That's my focus. But, you know, I have, you know, plenty of artists, musicians, you know, people in film. Yeah. So the concepts are the same.
Hmm.
And what I tell parents is, you know, your role is to walk with your son or daughter to help them find out what they're passionate about, right? Giving the opportunities, give them, you know, and supporting, walking with them, not pushing them, not pulling them, walking with them, let them experiment, let them find what they're good at.
Yeah, what they're drawn to, what they love, what makes their heart sing, all that stuff. You bet. So can I change, well, I'm not even sure it's a changing direction in a moment, but I know you wrote a book called The Time Cleanse.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm assuming that has something to do with your work in coaching. But so could you talk a little bit about that?
What is that about? Yeah. So 2019, or 2018, I got a publishing deal with McGraw-Hill. They published the book for me. And what it was this. I've been coaching a long time. And the years before that, I would see the number one problem that I saw with people. And it was, I don't have enough time. I mean, it was client after client after client. I started researching, you know, what I could do as a coach and as an author to help them get control of their time. And what I found was, in my early research, is that most people have an adversarial relationship with time. I don't have enough time. If my schedule allows, I mean, just even thinking about that phrase, if my schedule allows, aren't you the one creating the schedule? So, you know, what I realized is that we needed to shift the paradigm. Instead of managing time, how do we perform with it? So a couple years of research, got the book out right before COVID. And it's really a system of how to align yourself. First of all, identifying what are your values? What matters to you? See, when you align your values, then you start seeing where your time is. Okay. What's your purpose? And then the actual time cleanse process is evaluating every single thing you do in your personal and business life. It takes 30 minutes. And then you go through, is this contributing or contaminating my ultimate purpose, what I want, my goal? And it's a very simple process of accepting, rejecting, and removing, you know, those things, adjusting the time, and then reinvesting the time where you want to succeed at. So the beginning of the book is an alignment. The second part of the book is the process. And the third part of the book is how to perform, how to schedule, tools to use. And, you know, ultimately, you know, when I wrote the book, I trademarked a phrase called timefulness. And so timefulness is a little more focused part of mindfulness. It's being present, aware, and intentional with your time.
Mm.
And knowing that time is here for us to fulfill our highest purpose. And when we get in alignment with time, when we get in alignment with time, it's here for us. Time pressure is the number one thing that will reduce performance. The number one thing. When we feel we don't have enough time, our cognition changes, our creativity changes. And so when we start realizing, hey, I am time by what I choose my yeses and nos to, and no matter what, always in the mantra is there's enough time. Now, when we adjust things in our life, we have plenty of time. And I still, you know, after writing that book, a lot of my clients for many years still struggle with that because, you know, the messaging is there's not enough time. There is plenty of time for what matters. Mm. There's not enough time for all the things that don't matter. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, getting that book done was, you know, is really one of my bucket lists. And now, the beauty that I'm focusing on athletes is that's one of the biggest things I'm helping young people with, how to focus their time, how to schedule, because time is the biggest asset if you're in the arts, if you're a student athlete, because knowing where and how to invest that time is going to determine a huge part of your success. And that's why I say your relationship with time is the most important relationship you have, because when that's aligned, you can be your full self. You can be relevant. With the lack of alignment, you're just struggling.
Right. You're meandering, which is, you know, has its place, I suppose. But
well, yeah. Well, it's funny you say that, because in the book, I talk about doing nothing, being bored. There is a time, because this is the biggest challenge for kids. It's like the space of non-doing.
Non-doing.
Is the place where creativity arises.
Absolutely.
Insight. You know, I meditate twice a day for 20 minutes. I'm a Vedic meditator. I'm actually going to India next month for 2 weeks to Rishikesh. And, you know, taking the time to be present. So meditation is one of the things that I teach. And that time to
be with self. And do you teach it as meditation to your
athletes? Yeah, I teach it straight out. I don't
covertly
do
anything.
And so, but I teach it in a very performance way. I say, listen, what happens when you're performing? If you're an executive, a mom, an athlete, what happens to your performance when you get distracted? Everyone's, you know, this is a simple sign. My performance goes down. So when I teach meditation, I change the frame a bit. And what I teach them is when you're meditating, you're creating a state of being present. Over time, that can be a trait, right? Yeah. And so we train the mind to be in the moment, and when we get distracted, have a better ability to come back. And that lands with people. We're not trying to, you know, levitate off the ground. We're not trying to feel good. we're practicing. And part of this, David, which is funny, is I have to, in the first 5 minutes of this, I have to unwire every thought they have about meditation.
Exactly. And
people go, oh, I'm a bad meditator. I go, can you sit here? Yeah. I go, can you follow your breath? They're like, yeah. I go, you have a PhD in meditation.
There you go.
Right. So, but that is, you know, back to the phrase, the more present you are, the higher you perform.
Yeah.
If there is a backdrop of all of it, it's teaching people to be present. Now, I want you to see the head of training here. His name's Mana. I want to show you Mana. Mana, come here, buddy. You're gonna be a guest here. Come here, buddy. Come here, buddy. And the reason, David, I'm showing you him, say hello to the world. This is Mana.
Hey there, Mana.
The shorty boy.
Hey, Mana.
Hey, buddy.
How are you, buddy? Guys.
So the reason I'm bringing him here as the head of training is, you know, when I do training with young people in the NFL, I'll bring him because he is the best example of being in the moment. You know, animals are the greatest teachers. So, you know, I have them just observe. Look at Mana. What is he doing? He's in the moment. He's curious. He's not thinking about, oh man, am I going to start tomorrow? Man, I really screwed up that last.
I wonder what's for dinner.
Right. He's just like, hey, I'm here. And, you know, it's just a great example. And then, you know, when a dog, you see him shake his body, he's shaking it off. He's shaking an emotional state off. And so it's a great tool for all of us to just take and go, how can I be more like a dog?
Yeah.
Be right here. And he's been a great added to my life personally and to the teaching.
Well, I have a, this might be an unfair question, but what's Stephen Griffin's A game look like? You asked that of your athletes, et cetera. Yeah.
So my A game, when I analyze it, it's very similar. So the categories are the same. And so we have internal A game, and then we have an environmental A game, right? So when I'm at my A game, I've slept well, I've meditated, I've been hydrating, and I'm monitoring my thoughts, monitoring what I'm telling myself. When I work with the athletes, and so I have my A game days, I got my B game days, and I got my F game days.
Yeah,
I'm on this journey. Now I've learned to regulate different things. I've learned how to, you know, recover from upsets, from the tools, from breath work, from cognitive things, the meditation. But ultimately, you know, I know what it takes to be at my best. And over the years of teaching it, you know, if you want to be great at something, teach it. And so I've got into a better space of being more consistently in my A games, but I've got my bad days like everyone else.
And you don't beat yourself up when you have them, do you?
Right. And so that's the opportunity. Still, from time to time. I mean, I'm still a recovering critical mind guy, but right. Now
recovering human. Yeah.
Right. So now it's like, okay, you've been beating yourself up for a day. So now it's just a day, not 6 months.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, really paying attention to and taking that time to evaluate my day. So when I teach athletes, executives, same thing, I have a simple worksheet at the end of the day. It's called your after performance evaluation. It's super simple. What went well with my effort and my results? Number one. Number two, what were any challenges I had today? Or what are areas that I want to grow in? You fill it out. And number three, what am I going to apply? And what am I going to do different tomorrow? Super simple.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives us an analysis, and that's where we can compress time.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I'm just being sensitive to time, and I'm not sure we still have some, but I want to make sure. So if I knew what I was talking about, what would I be asking that I haven't asked you?
Dave, you're pretty funny. It's all those years working with those kids, right?
Oh, they're the best, man. They're the best. Working with kids is about the best thing I could do.
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing that I wanted to comment on is the role of parents that we talked about a little bit. But the number one question I get when I speak or train from parents is, how do I talk to my kid?
Hmm. Really?
Surprisingly, and it's more than that, how do I create the environment for my son or daughter to thrive? Number one question. There's nothing even close. And what I tell parents, you know, so when I teach parents, it's everything I teach athletes, just with a different wrapper. It's the same thing. What's your A game as a parent?
Mm-hmm.
How do you regulate yourself? A lot of the, when I take on a young athlete, I'm coaching the parents too. There's some sessions built in there. And a lot of it is, you know, we're in such a high competitive world. Right. You said, well, what's different now? Well, what's different now is the amount of time, travel teams, the amount of time. I mean, that is radically different.
Unbelievable.
And so what I tell parents is really simple. I share that after performance evaluation. I think maybe this is a good place. I said, so, you know, the after performance conversation, the drive home conversation. Right. I say, how do you connect with your young daughter or your young son after a competition? And so I remember early on in my career, a woman came up and I said, would you want to volunteer what you do? She's really motivated. She's like, yeah. I said, so let's go through how you talk to your son, a young baseball player. I still remember this like yesterday. And I go, let's role play. Okay, I'm going to be your son. You're going to be you. We get in the car. Doors closed. Just came off the field 10 minutes ago. Start. What do you do? And she had this like smile on her face. She's like, well, I start like this. Why didn't you run to second base that fast? What happened? You know, and everybody in the room was laughing, David. Everyone could relate, right, at some level. And so as she started talking, this is what I did. The laughter is bellowing. I go, you know what's happening right now, right? We stopped the exercise. She goes, yeah, I just can't help myself. I go, your son is listening to zero.
Right.
So I said, let's switch it up. Okay. Now I'm going to be you. You be your son. Doors close. Silence for 10 minutes. We're not even talking. She's like, you could see her like. So then I said, hey, Johnny, what do you think went well today? Well, you know, I kind of screwed up. No. What do you think you did well? Well, you know, my first at bat was good. You know, I had a good attitude. Awesome. You know, I can support you on that. What were any challenges you had, or what are areas you want to get better at? Man, I struck out 3 times and I'm just beating myself up. Okay. Well, what can we do together? What can you do, or how can I support you to work on that? See, we want to step into the emotional environment of our athlete. If we teach and preach first, they're hearing nothing.
Right.
If we can enter their world emotionally, God, they're suffering right now. This is a self-compassion exercise. They're suffering. Okay, let me attend to, and it can even start off with, yeah, I can imagine, you know, you're kind of bummed out right now. I can imagine. So we're going there first. We're going there first. Then we're moving into how we can affect performance change. It took me many years, David, to get to this point. Man, I was a hard charger earlier. Like, we're going to fix this. We're going to fix this. And never even being connected to, gosh, what's their emotional state?
Right.
And so for parents, I think, you know, that's one of the things that I've been able to help them with, is just to take that step back. And then also, you know, the old phrase, you got the helicopter parent, right? You got that type of parent. And then you have parents that are completely hands off. I mean, we kind of want to be right in the middle there. And right. We want to allow our kids to fail forward. We're in a society today, and I don't know if you saw this in your career, where everything's protected.
Oh.
I don't want that failure. I don't want this. Mm-hmm. And that's why we got kids at 30 living at home still. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it, but it's like, you know, when I grew up, you know, 20, 21, so we want them. And this is the one thing for kids, is understanding that, you know, there's no failure. There's learning. We're learning. And if you are not failing, you are not going for it.
Right.
And having them know you're the safety net.
Right.
You're the safety net. You're not the training wheel.
No, right, exactly.
And I'll give you a good example of this. So one of my seminars, I had a mom come up afterwards, and she said, you know, this goes back to the communication about the A game and helping kids, you know, speak at a good volume, good body posture, very common, you know, for young men and young women. And so she said, you know, when he's talking to coaches or recruiting him, how do I get him to be more articulate, communicate more? Right. I said, that's a great question. And then I said, do you ever order food? You ever order pizza? She's like, yeah, all the time. I go, did your son ever order pizza? She looked at me like, what are you talking about? I go, do you ever have your son was like 12 or 13.
Yeah, right? Sure.
I said, do you ever have him pick up the phone? Not online. Pick up the phone. Call a local pizzeria and order. She goes, She goes, no. I go, start having him order pizza. So then she says to me, this is, you know, you get these gifts from God, of these examples, right? She goes, well, I'm afraid he's going to go hungry if I don't. So I started laughing. I said, let me tell you something.
That's not good.
That young man, when you put the visa on the table and you go, you're going to eat if you call. You're not going to eat if you don't call. You'll have
that.
He'll be paying for the fastest delivery to your house. But that is an example of a lot of the thinking. And it's not a criticism of parents, because here's the big part. People just don't know. And so my job is, with compassion, to give the tools, the techniques, the mindsets to help the parents, the athletes, and the coaches create the best environment for growth.
So you work with other coaches?
Oh yeah.
You coach coaches.
Yeah. So I've coached coaches from the NFL all the way down to Pee-wees, and you know, really? how to give feedback. This is another topic for young people. In my entire athletic career, no one told me how to take feedback.
Right.
Think about it.
Giving feedback is one thing, but actually being able to take it in is such a different
skill. Exactly. So I teach both, but here's the thing is, if we don't know how to receive feedback, it's going to stunt our ability to increase our performance, right? And so what I tell young people around performance is this, real simple. Number one, when you're getting feedback, don't defend, don't argue, don't take it personally, okay? So start there. Get yourself emotionally in the right place. Some breath technique, ground yourself, right? And then take the feedback in. Now, if the coach is asking or you want to articulate your position on that, wait till you get it. Number two, not all feedback is true.
Yes, exactly. Right.
So, you know, I'm empowering athletes to start thinking about it. I always tell athletes, if you're getting the same feedback multiple times, or the coach that's responsible for your playing, you should probably pay attention to it. And it's not always true. So getting, you know, young people emotionally grounded to receive that, super important. And then for coaches and parents, you know, I use the feedback sandwich model a lot of times. Here's specifically what went well. Hey, your effort was great today on the field. And here's an area that I think we can have some improvement, you know, better follow through on your swing, finishing it up with, and your effort was awesome. Positive specific, the challenge specific, finishing off with a positive specific. And then lastly, we want to try to stay in a 3-to-4-to-1 positive engagement versus correction. We know from the research, a 3-to-1 ratio is a great ratio. So we want to be mindful, and it's not going to be this, but if our coaching or our parenting is, this is what's wrong, this is what's wrong, this is what's wrong,
right,
versus here are these things you're doing well, and notice I said and, not but, and here are the things we can work on. And when we start creating the environments, man, kids flourish. Kids flourish. I wanted to say one other comment about the time concept. So when I finished writing my book, I came up with really this concept about time. And it says that I believe it's the best encapsulation in a sentence or two. Time, David, is for one thing: to create memories that matter and a legacy you're proud of.
Mm. Memories that matter.
Think about it. On our deathbed, if we have the pleasure of easing into the next, wherever the next is, no one's thinking about Instagram likes. No one's thinking about, man, I wish I had that purple Ferrari and that gold Rolex.
Yeah. Right.
No, it's what did I do that mattered?
Right.
And so maybe a kind of a final comment on, so my coaching philosophy is really simple. And it changed about 5 years ago. And it was one of my mentors, Tom Knowles, who's a, you know, Vedic teacher. He was with the Maharishi in India, you know, when the Beatles were there. It was one of my guides in my life. Even coaches need coaches, right?
Sure.
And he presented this philosophy to me. He said, Stephen, it's really about being relevant. And I said, well, what do you mean about that? He goes, well, it's connecting your gifts and talents to the need of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So realizing, you know, what am I good at and how can this help the collective? That's what it's about when it comes to being relevant. In that, happiness, success will be part of it. But a lot of our culture now is focused on being happy, being comfortable, not being relevant.
Right. And not responding to what is and what is the need. Yeah. Now. Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah.
I agree with that. Yeah. Well, Stephen Griffin, what a pleasure. What a pleasure. So I'm hoping that, you know, in one of my trips to Los Angeles, we have the opportunity to sit in the same room rather than sit on his.
Oh, David, you're not, listen, you're not getting away from me. It's not going to be hope. We'll make it happen. Just let me know when you're in town. We'll come up and we'll break some bread, have a coffee.
That'll be great. That'll be great.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.